The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Hi, this is Natalia, and I'm with the inimitable Morgan Jerkins, first of her name, layer of my life, just the best, one of like my top favorite people that I follow on Twitter. Morgan, how are you today?
I am good. How are you?
Oh my gosh, so excited. So excited to talk to you. Okay. So we're here to talk all things Call Baby, which is your newest book coming out April 6th, if I'm correct. And it is your first fiction book, which is just wild. I could not tell that this was your first fiction book at all. I thought it was just beautifully written and just amazing. So to start, why don't we give our listeners just kind of a quick, give me an elevator synopsis of the book without giving away too many spoilers or spoil it. I mean, shit, it's your book, whatever you want to do.
Got it. Okay. So what I will say about this is, you know, Call Baby is a story about a family of Black women who sells their call, which is in African-American folklore, it's said to be a source of healing and protection. They sell it as a sort of capitalistic enterprise. And this capitalistic enterprise gets complicated when they get connected to another Black family in the neighborhood, which is in a gentrifying Harlem. And so I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's a novel that not only blends magical realism, but also themes of gentrification, survival, familial obligation, and of course, Black motherhood, which is something that I'm very obsessed with.
I mean, there's so much to unpack in the book, and I am very lucky to have been given an advanced reader's copy. So I've gotten my hands on it before, you know, a lot of people have. And I remember the first night that I read it, I was like, okay, I'm going to read just like a few chapters just to get into it. And the next thing I know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm sobbing on my couch.
Really?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I don't want to get into spoilers, but it was like a pivotal scene between three characters, Josephine, Helena, and Hollow. Mm-hmm. And it was the moment where kind of Josephine gathered Helena and told her about herself and was like, this is why you are the way that you are. And Helena had a whole moment just as the reader. You watched her break and move forward. And I may have been in my feelings that night.
But
I'm just like, oh my gosh.
Well, I think what I wanted people to understand is, so I will have been living in Harlem for 6 years this July. And of course you can't live in a neighborhood like this and not have it affect you. Mm-hmm. I think within like the first 2 years of living in Harlem, I have seen the neighborhood change so much. So imagine what the neighborhood must feel like for someone who lived here since the late 90s. Like that's where the book first starts. And then into, you know, 2020 or 2019. And, you know, even though this book is set within a city that is as vibrant and historical as Harlem, it also has a bit of a very intimate and sometimes claustrophobic feel, because I wanted the readers to understand that these women are desperate. And what I mean by that is they understand that nobody's going to look out for them besides them. And how many times has Black women have heard that phrase? But it's even more intensified because of the gift that they have. And so because of that, because they are so desperate to maintain their familial cohesiveness and also maintain their presence in Harlem when everyone else is being uprooted, that leads them to dire straits.
I think one of the things that struck me in the book is, so I'm from the Bronx originally. I did not grow up in New York. I grew up in Florida, but I went back as an adult to intern, and my mom would be like, oh, look up this place. I used to take you there when you were a baby, or look here. And those places don't exist anymore. And I would send pictures to my mom and she would be like, this is wild. You know, this is crazy. And so that disappearance of home, I think as someone who I have a, like, and I just moved to Georgia. So that's another thing. I think maybe why this book is just hitting me on so many levels, right? But disappearance of home, even while you're still there, amplified by the pandemic and the isolation that I think a lot of us are feeling, I'm sitting in this book and I'm just going, I can see, I may not live in Harlem. I may not have that exact experience, but man, I know what it's like to look around you and wonder, like, is this really where I grew up? is this my home, or has it been taken away while I was here? Was I robbed while I was at the house? And that's such a, I think it's such a powerful feeling to be able to transmit to someone via text. Like, it's not like you're explaining it to me, you know, with your words, but I'm so moved. I'm so moved by that concept. But let's talk a little bit about this family. And is it Melon? So I've been saying it in my head, Melonzones, because in Spanish that name has an S sound.
You are the first person who pronounced it correctly. Melanson is a name. So these women are Creole. So Creole, Cajun, it's pronounced Melanson. But everybody says Melancon. So I was like, I'm not even going to correct them. But you're the first person that's pronounced it correctly.
I would just like to say that I will own this moment forever. It will be on audio forever. So the Melanson women are ride or die for each other.
Oh, yes.
In really disastrous and inappropriate ways.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about your inspiration for this family. Who birthed these women? Is this really your family? Like, is your sister out there going, I see this, I'm Josephine, or I'm Iris Morgan? I don't know what's going on.
No. So the first thing is, I will say that the idea of call bearing women, one of the threads of inspiration was my aunt, my mother's older sister, because she can read people like no other. And I remember one time in passing, my mother told me it was said that she was born with a veil, which where I'm from, that means a call.
Yeah, that's how we say it in Spanish.
Right. Okay. So yeah, but these women, I just wanted to make complicated Black women. I wanted people to understand the warmth and the intensity of these intimate spaces that we build for ourselves, the type of conversation that we don't always talk about outside of our bedroom or our hallways and et cetera, et cetera. And that's why I wanted the brownstone in which they live to be larger than life, in a sense, to be full, to almost be personified. And so, you know, with these women, like, I will say, I can't say that I just made them up in my head. You know what I'm saying? Because I've been around Black women all my life. I'm inspired by Black women. I could be walking down the street and see two, you know, aunties just see each other and they start a conversation, and I can be inspired by their cadence, the timbre of their voices, or the content of what they're saying. So these women, I think, are definitely an amalgamation of women that I've seen in passing, or I know intimately, but they've just been taken up a notch. They've been dramatized for the sake of a novel.
Maman reminds me of my tía. So she is
large. She is the matriarch of the family. She is in charge. What she says goes. In my family, we call her the Mayimba, which is like the chief almost.
Wow. Wow.
And every time an interaction came with Mamang, I was like, oh, that's my tia Jacqueline. That's who that is.
Wow.
And then she, you know, she gets smaller as the book progresses and time goes by and she becomes less. And she's no longer that imposing figure. And a part of you wonders, you know, is it my memory that made her larger than life? Or is it just the passage of time? And I see that in my own life. Like my own aunt is, I'm 33 now. Like I'm a grown ass woman and I go to my aunt and sometimes I feel like I'm 7. And other times I'm like, wow, she's just a person. Holy shit.
Right. Right. And I'll tell you, you know, my mom, obviously she's in the book. I describe her as, you know, she's really tall and she's statuesque, but I'll tell you, you know, the way I thought of her grandiosity, you'll never believe this. I was sitting on the train and there was a woman that was on the train and she kind of reminded me of Toni Morrison because she had on like this black small hat and these long gray dreadlocks that looked like vines. Like they just were just cascading down her body and she sat perched on the subway. And I'm looking at her and I'm like, she's not supposed to be here. Like for some reason, obviously in New York, you see so many people, it's like, as I kept staring at her, I was just like, every time I look at her, I feel like we're not even in a city anymore. We're someplace rural, we're someplace primordial, we're someplace, we're someplace ancestral. And that was what I wanted to sort of evoke with Mama, is like, she is here, but she's been here.
Yes, yes. There's a scene where she's talking to Josephine and Josephine is having like a vulnerable moment with her mother and her mother is engaging her in this vulnerability, which is not common in their relationship. And she kind of talks to her about her past and there's this softness within her. And the thing that immediately came to mind is, geez, we really do contain multitudes, right?
Yes.
And how much of those multitudes do we have to contain because we're not allowed to be who we need to be all of the time. Kind of going back to your idea of we are not one-dimensional tropes, any one of us, right?
Right.
We're not just angry Black women. And I think it would have been so easy for you to fall into that trap as the writer. Oh, angry Black matriarch. Wow, congrats. But she's so hurt and she's so damaged and she carries that with her and has to build her life around it because who's going to, anyways, I could write a thesis on her. I really could.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to see like, hey, this woman is, she's not just an angry Black matriarch because hell yeah, she's angry.
Oh yeah.
But
let's be very clear. She is very, very, very,
right.
Very, very fed up with,
right.
I think the systems.
Right. Right. And also it's like, this woman has lost everything. She's lost her way of life in Louisiana. She had to migrate. She's lost her husband. The only things that she has is her home and her daughters. That's the only thing. And that's what I think, what I wanted people to understand is like, you may not agree with them, but I want you to understand where they're coming from. And that's what I get inspired from when I watch any type of TV show, or any type of movie, even if I don't like you or I don't like what you do, if I understand the motive behind it, that's what makes for a compelling story.
For sure. For sure. And I think if you look at the dialogue and just Twitter or life, whatever, it so often we're just reduced to unidimensional characters. Like that's it. We are one thing. We are not allowed to contain many things. And I don't know, that stuck with me. So I don't want to like take up all of your time, but let's talk about Amara. So Amara is, for our listeners, Amara is the second Black family that Morgan alluded to earlier. And she has a very complicated relationship. I think I can adequately say that, a very complicated relationship with the Melanson family. And Amara has to navigate primarily white spaces as a woman of color, mm-hmm. and has to balance being herself and having this identity that she has, her own family history, her own familial trauma, dealing with her aunt Layla, dealing with her mom Denise, all of that, and then has to kind of code switch at a moment's notice to say, nope, I'm gonna be this person now. I'm gonna be the studious student, or I'm gonna be the great girlfriend, or I'm gonna be the perfect daughter. And it is so rare that we glimpse those moments of vulnerability for her, but when they happen, they're freaking disastrous.
Yeah.
And so what I want to ask you is, why did you put a camera in my room? Like, were you reading my journals? Like, how did that happen? How did I get put in your book? Like, what happened?
Well, I could not put you on my book, but I think the thing is like, I thought of Amara since Call Baby was a short story. Originally, Call Baby wasn't even supposed to be a novel. So, but the thing is that my ideas of Amara's characterization sharpened with the ascent of Vice President Kamala Harris, because there was so much conversation mm-hmm. about, yes, this woman is a maverick, but look at what she had done to Black communities in California. There was so much discourse about it. And I wanted to dramatize that for Amara, where it's like, this woman has a vendetta and she's been holding on to this vendetta for almost two decades. And she is gonna stop at nothing to get to the top and to chastise this call-bearing family for what they did to her aunt years ago. And I'm not gonna spoil what they did. But the thing is that what you see with Amara is oftentimes when you are so full of vengeance, when you have such a vengeful spirit, you have these blind spots. And what she probably didn't realize till she got into the thick of the role is that if you're trying to appease the police, your superiors, and all these other agents of the carceral state, you are going to have umpteen Black and brown casualties in your wake. That's why I started the second half of the book with her being on this road to glory and suffering mentally with the weight of these decisions, all because she wants that family in Harlem to go down.
So I come from a legal background, and one of the things that you're taught, I'm not an attorney, let's be mm-hmm. very clear, I'm not an attorney, mm-hmm. but I'm attorney adjacent, right? And one of the things that even attorney adjacent people are taught and that is hammered into you is that you practice the law dispassionately. There is no room for feelings in the law because it is very much right or wrong, right? Like the law is written down. It's not made up. It's not verbal. It's literally written down in black and white. And you have to apply it allegedly, dispassionately to everyone. And I have been in meetings where I know that technically what I'm doing is the right thing. You get a preponderance of evidence. You look at the facts of the matter, like facts of the case. And you come to an analysis and you have to defend your position, and technically it's right. But emotionally, you wonder, are those decisions going to come back to haunt you? And luckily for me, I'm not in the criminal world. My issues were a lot more like hospitality related. So nobody's dying because of my decisions. But let's talk about the political kind of overtones of this, right? So I do not believe that politics are impersonal. I think that to say that politics are impersonal is admitting really loudly that you've got a privilege mm-hmm. that other people don't have. Like, oh, I don't have to talk about politics. I'm cool. Cool story, bro. And in this book, you mentioned briefly gentrification. What I wanted to talk to you as well about maternal mortality rates among Black women and mental health. Oh my gosh, the mental health
Yeah.
Just everybody in this book needed 80,000 years of intensive therapy, and not one of them got it.
Yeah. Well, because these women believe they're special.
Yeah.
And what I tried to show was that, listen, even if this call makes them impervious to physical pain, on the inside, they are still pained. I think the thing is like with regards to Black maternal mortality rates, well, I'll just say this, like, you know, I've been inspired or rather affected by the avalanche of stories about how dangerous it is to be a Black expectant mother in this country. You know, my father is an OBGYN. My father has dedicated his entire career to centering Black urban women, particularly in low income neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so that has definitely affected me. You know, I think about how my own mother was pressured to abort because she was so sick with me, you know?
Really?
Yes. So there's so many Black women I know that have had fertility struggles, miscarriages, problems at the hospital that affects us irrespective of education and tax bracket.
Yeah.
And so that has affected me because, you know, I'm thinking about this family and I think about how dangerous it is to be a Black woman who creates, and not only creates, but creates life, and how complicated that can be within a capitalistic project known as the United States of America. And how do you reconcile that? Or is there no reconciliation? And these are the things that I really did not want to provide answers for. I have always made it my duty, even in my nonfiction works, that I love the irresolute. I don't believe that I need to tie everything up with a bow. I don't believe that I need to give everyone a clear-cut answer, because that's just not how life is.
Exactly.
And I think when it comes to Black women, we often expect them to have the answers for everything. We often expect them to be the end-all, be-all, and to put us at ease.
You have to uplift the community. You have to push it forward. You have to take care of everybody. But you can't do it without being too mad.
Yeah.
You can't do it too passionately. You can't do it too loudly. And you can't fail at all. You cannot fail. And if you do, it's just everybody's fucked. And that's just wild. Wild. Right.
And also to me, I'm just like, and that's why I wanted to make a book. Well, how would you like it if I centered Black women who only care about themselves? Literally centered them. They don't care about nobody else, even those that look like them. What would that look like?
I don't know how to explain to somebody who is not Black or who is not brown what that feels like when you have to balance your own community with yourself.
Yes. Yes.
That is a tight wire, man.
It is. And it's like, and I even think about it with regards to being an artist. When you're a Black artist, it's like you have a social responsibility that white people just do not have. And that's not to say that it's wrong, but it does exist. And yep. I constantly bring it up. So it's like, I wanted to center Black women who are like, listen, I care about me and mine. And obviously it's not smooth sailing, but I wanted to turn that inside out, to be in a neighborhood as communal as Harlem, but to be so insular at the same time.
Yep. So I have to ask, as you were writing this book that has grown with you, that has evolved with you, that has matured as you've matured and as you've seen these things, you know, do you worry that a well-meaning white woman will take this and say, well, I mean, see, ultimately, everybody just wants the best for themselves and their family, and kind of miss the larger conversation that we're having, which is, there are systems in place that made it so they had to be this way. And the real conversation that we should be having is, how do you disrupt those systems so that we don't have to live this way? You know what I mean?
Right. So what I'll say is that I haven't really been thinking about that. And the reason why I haven't is because if I were thinking about the well-meaning white woman who would grab my book, I would over-explain so much. In the book writing process, that once it got into your hands, it would lose so much of its immediacy. and so much of the emotion behind it that almost transcends language itself. So when I think about it, like if a well-meaning white woman says in my presence, you know, what you just said, I'll obviously correct her. But I personally believe that if a white woman read this book in 2021 and, you know, thought that this is just a story of a family, a deracinated, because, you know, if you don't say black, yeah, a deracinated family that just does whatever they can for their family, then that person chose not to read what they wanted to read. Because I made it clear from the dialect, from the different shades of brown, from the Great Migration backstory to the implication of white people and their lust, basically, to feed off of their bodies. Mm-hmm. That if it is the case that, you know, someone reduces it to generality, that's because the story made them uncomfortable. And to that person that who said that, I would say to them, what was about this story that made you so uncomfortable that you took the bone and marrow from these characters in the way that you did? Now, I don't want to put any words in anyone's mouth, white, black, brown, because it may not happen. But if it did, I would ask someone that, because I would say, what in this book do you think this is just some regular, as Cardi, you say, regular, degular family? What would make you think that?
Yeah.
Because I mean, when it comes to the racial dynamics, I am not covert at all.
So I have two very enthusiastic thumbs up for this book, but I'd like Thank to you. End this interview with a very serious and a very important question, which is, why is Landon the worst?
Oh, no. Oh, because he's complicated. He's just as trapped as Josephine is. You know what I'm saying? And no, I'm not gonna make excuses for him, you know, but he don't know what to do. He don't know what to do. And the thing is like, I'm sure many people that date men are gonna read this, like, men are trash. And listen, you are entitled to your opinion, but the way that I'm trying to say this in a way that doesn't spoil what happens. But
I know. It's so hard.
But the thing about Landon is just like, again, desperation.
Yeah.
And desperation works differently in so many different people. And when I created what happened to him, when I thought about how the ending was going to be, I was like, what other choice was there going to be? You know, for I couldn't think of another possible solution to what was happening.
But also, who would play him if somebody put this in a movie?
Landon, I would probably say Andre Holland. You know who he is? Andre Holland. He was in Moonlight.
Yes.
Or like I would say maybe Jonathan Majors. From Lovecraft Country, I think that Andre Holland would probably be able to capture the fragility more.
Yes, and that is true. He is a fragile man, and I, as much as I disliked him as a character, I understood his motivations, and this is something we talked about even before the recording started, which is where the motivations need to be present, right? So,
oh yeah,
I don't like him. I would like to throw him out, but I get him. And I thought that there was something beautiful about having a fragile black man on a page, and it, again, not reducing him to just, I'm a Shakespeare fan, like, all Dominican men are cheaters.
Yeah. I'm not doing that. And that's the thing. It's like, it's the same thing with Layla, Amara's aunt, her husband, Ralph. I wanted people to understand that grief affects men too. Obviously, it doesn't affect them the same way as women who carry children, but it rips them from the inside out too. They just may not show it in the same way that their female counterparts do. And that's why I wanted to show their strength in certain parts, but I also wanted to show that they break too.
Yes. And it goes back to just like, we're not, like, we are not single dimensions. Nobody is. We are not two dimensionals.
No. Nope.
We contain multitudes. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for everything. This has been great. And where can people follow you if they already aren't following you, or catch up with you, or learn more about you, or any of that stuff?
You can follow me on just Morgan Jerkins on Twitter, on Instagram, _ Morgan Jerkins, all lowercase. Or, you know, you can look on my website, morgan-jerkins.com. Very simple.
Love it. Well, everybody go out and buy Call Baby when it comes out on April 6th. Mm-hmm. And tag Morgan in all of your good reviews. But Morgan, thank you so much. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Likewise. All right. Thank you so much. All right. Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a